And our sermon text today is Romans 11, 1 to 6. I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. For I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets, they have demolished your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. There is in the nomenclature of quilting. Yeah, this is one of Debbie's quilts. This is a remnant quilt. And as I worked on the message this past week, I thought immediately of this because Debbie, as she was putting this together, was gathering remnants of fabric from all over the place, stuff that I would go make motions to toss in the waste can, and she'd say, wait, bring that back. And so Debbie, over the course of 10 years, put this together. It's not the only thing she did. She was also raising kids and keeping house and tending to her husband, too. But I remember because we would... And when we drive someplace, you know, back home for Christmas when I was in seminary, or out candidating when we were missionary candidates, she'd be having her lap as we drove a portion of this quilt over 10 years. So this is a remnant quilt. Scraps I would have thrown away, she has managed to put into this beautiful quilt. Now, we've had this off and on. On our bed then for periods of time too, and I just get to see a whole variety of quilts that she's done. This is one reason I want you to pray for her and her arthritis too, because she won't be able to do stuff like this with when the arthritis gets to her. But this is a remnant quilt, and it's just a perfect metaphor for what God is doing with the church too, as he takes remnants then and makes of us. What might be, at first glance, unrelated, irrelevant pieces into a whole integrated, beautiful work of art. God takes remnants, remnant people, and turns them into a wondrous, beautiful testament to his marvelous grace, doesn't he? The Apostle Paul reflects on this in our text today and makes three points that I want to make with you then today. As you see your outline, consult your outline. You have those three points for you. First of all, in verses 1 to 2a, we have remnant. That's our theme, our motif for today, remnant. He's taking an Old Testament Israelite Jewish godly motif and reflecting on it today, remnant. It is demonstrable that God has not rejected Israel altogether, the Apostle Paul being Exhibit A. The Apostle Paul is Exhibit A, that God has not rejected Israel altogether. Now, these chapters are a study in contrast. They go back and forth. You have to have your thinking cap on. You have to be able to think through sustained chapters 9, 10, and 11, to be able to make sense of his arguments here. Because after having just painted Israel, as he knew it, now, under the new covenant, in its worst possible light, you look back to verse 21, where he concludes by saying, but Israel, he, that is Isaiah, says, all day long I have held up my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. This is Israel. Israel, worthy of exile and destruction as they were back in the days of the Old Covenant. Well, he now seems, perhaps, to some, to contradict himself by putting before us those who are not disobedient and contrary. That is, a number of Jews obedient to the gospel. But any contradiction is really only an apparent one, since God has always used a remnant to glorify himself as he builds a covenant people, even as Debbie builds quilts with remnants. This theme of redemptive history, it is a theme of redemptive history. That's a theme that you have heard often from here, that God saves in time and space in redemptive history. And one of the favorite themes or motifs then of this is the remnant motif, the se'arit motif in the Hebrew, se'arit, the remnant motif or theme, since it occurs so frequently in the Bible. And we know God acts thematically. He repeats behaviors that characterize him. Using remnants to construct new glorious things is one of those behaviors that characterizes the God of the Bible. We can glory in this. We can predict, not predict so much as count on, have faith in these thematic, these redemptive themes and motifs. Characterizes all through history, right? We saw that in our Old Testament reading. Joseph says, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. 2 Kings tells us, for out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord will do this. Jeremiah puts it this way, then I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I have driven them, and I will bring them back to their fold, and they shall be fruitful and multiply. So this is one of those motifs, one of those themes that we love, I hope you love, to see unfolded through Scripture. God may have at one time or another in redemptive history great numbers, flourishing numbers of believers, flourishing number of the chosen. But there are those times in redemptive history when the numbers wane, when the numbers fall, when it's impossible to see his church, his people, perhaps at times. But there is indeed always a remnant. God always has a faithful remnant upon the earth. He has always had a church, contrary to the LDS and their idea of the falling away of the church, right? But when those large numbers wane, when a whole people in general are disobedient and contrary, still, God always preserves a remnant of them with whom to build a new people of God, and he destroys the rest. Saw that in the Great Flood, right? When only eight persons, a few, were saved. And then, as Israel went into the land, we find in Numbers, surely none of the men who came up out of Egypt, God says, right? He points the people who did enter the land back, reflecting. He says, surely none of the men who came up out of Egypt from 20 years old and upward shall see the land that I swore to give Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, none except a remnant, right? None except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. That remnant motif, you see it beautifully woven into redemptive history all through the Bible. Well, with the Se'arit motif in this chapter come several issues the church faces today, and I want to take them up because they are especially highlighted here in chapter 11. Three things that you'll see me coming back to. Paul was not necessarily addressing but which have a great impact upon us in the life of the church today. Number one, is that remnant that se'arit, is that remnant a separate people with different promises and a different destiny than the church, that is, Israel remnant? Do they have a different destiny, different promises to them, separate from the church, or are they one with the church? And of course, this goes to the heart of the novel doctrine of dispensationalism. That is a system that's relatively recent in the life of the church. That is, the church and Israel are separate. And as you find us weaving, this is the most difficult chapter for dispensationalists to cope with, too, by the way. And dispensationalism, as we'll see, makes an incoherent hash of chapter 11 because they have to bend over backwards, do some theological twister to make sense of this chapter. But in order, of course, to preserve their prophetic approach, in which we see heifers in the headlines, temples in the treaties, the Antichrist and the anti-Clinton rhetoric, in order to preserve these things, we must have separate destinies and promises for the church, one people of God, and a second people of God with different covenants, different promises, and different destinies. Is this chapter telling us those things? Secondly, is that remnant, we're talking about the Se'arit motif, the Se'arit theme, has it ever been two peoples of God? No, it hasn't. But is that remnant then, secondly, the model for the Gentile believer under the new covenant, as she was for the believer under the old covenant, or the covenant signs, seals, liturgies, promises, traditions, as developed by the church under the new covenant, normative now for the Jew? This goes to the heart of the Messianic Jew movement. And this chapter addresses these issues too. Goes to the heart of the Messianic Jew movement, led by Rabbi Barry Rubin and articulated in the Complete Jewish Study Bible. Now, we treated of this, we kind of skimmed over it. You were introduced, if you were in the Sunday school class where we treated the 10 Bible tools that every Christian needs on their shelf, we treated a little bit on this issue, that is the Messianic Jew movement and some of the pitfalls, dangers inherent in it. You'll hear things amongst Messianic Jews like replacement theology. That's a relatively new term in the life of the church, a novel term. Calvin says this about novelty in doctrine and theology. He says, novelty is a grievous engine to torment weak minds. I love that. And he, of course, was talking about some novelties in his day, but there are always novelties, and you have to be suspicious. Oh, I have a new doctrine that I discovered, and I'm articulating now, right? Because novelty is a grievous engine to torment weak minds. I'm going to memorize that one. But the idea, indeed, that replacement theology characterizes the church, as, and when they talk about replacement theology, they're talking about covenant theology, i.e. Reformed theology, because this is the biggest obstacle in the way of the Messianic Jew, is overcoming the inertia of covenant theology over these millennia of teaching in the life of the church. That is, rather than having indeed the Jewish covenants, the old covenant, the Sinaitic covenant, we have replacement theology that has replaced that. You see the insidious nature of that term, replacement, rather than organically flowing out of the text as covenant theology does. They call it a replacement theology, that rather we have Israel and the Jew and the Sinaitic covenant, in which the new covenant spoken of in Jeremiah and reflected on then in Hebrews, the new covenant is indeed kind of an addendum a footnote to the Sinai covenant, and it was meant for Israel, to be made with Israel, and not to create a whole new church. Subtly, in the Messianic Jew movement, you have a functional denial of the church, and you have only Israel, and that we must now incorporate ourselves into the life of Israel, and that there needs to be a correction in the inertia of the church over the centuries back to Israel and not the church. So these are some of the dangers inherent. Not a big movement yet, but it's growing, gaining momentum, and there have been some Christians who have been taken in by the Messianic Jew movement. Not all Messianic Jews are of this stripe. There are some radical and some moderate Messianic Jews. So not all Messianic Jews. But if they indeed subscribe to the idea of the complete Jewish study Bible, and this has some good stuff in it, but its overall theme and momentum is indeed towards replacing the church with Israel. So this chapter helps address some of those issues, chapter 11. And then thirdly, we also want to get at the nature of covenant in general and the new covenant in order to understand these things. Because all of these questions and more fall into place once you understand the nature of covenant. You don't understand covenant, you will not understand this chapter. You don't understand covenant, you will fall into the traps of one of these other two teaching errors. So, to the question, if Israel is indeed a disobedient and contrary people, has he not rejected them? Paul answers in the strongest possible way, Megenito, by no means. He has not rejected his people. So, as we begin to unfold this chapter, it's important also to establish what Paul means by that little phrase, his people. What do we mean? What does Paul mean by his people? Generally, there's one of two options. Israel as a whole, number one. Israel as a whole, the nation or race of Jews. This was the fatal presumption, though, of the Jews who went into exile, that God loved and would save his people, that is, all Jews and Israelites because of their race and their nation in general. It was also the fatal flaw of the Jews who crucified Jesus. And it's also the fatal flaw of the Jews of the Messianic movement, because they are calling the church back to Jewish traditions, back to Jewish liturgies, back to temple forms and synagogue forms of worship, that the church needs a course correction in its momentum over the centuries, because God indeed is calling back. He's saving the Jew in his national and lineal sense. Or by his people, does Paul mean Israel as represented in the righteous elect whom God foreknew? Does Paul mean by his people, those represented, Israel as represented in the righteous elect whom God foreknew? And I think you know this is where we come down. And Paul, it's consistent with what Paul has already dealt with to some extent in chapters 9 through 10. Remember, he says back in chapter 9, not all Israel is Israel. We explained that phrase, what we mean by that. Not all of Israel, that is, just because you're lineally descended from a Jew, just because you're a blood member of the Jewish nation, does not mean you're a Jew. A Jew is one who has faith, who implements all of what Israel is and implements it by faith, i.e., he is a chosen one, an elect of God. He goes on to unfold that in chapter 9. So this is what Paul means when he says his people. He has not rejected his people, i.e., Israel who have faith. And Paul says he is exhibit A of this. Paul is exhibit A of Israel as the righteous elect now under the new covenant. And he establishes this by bringing out his bona fides, doesn't he? Now, he does it pretty extensively back in chapter 9. But he just kind of touches on, reviews a bit his bona fides. He's an Israelite. He's a descendant of Abraham. He's of the tribe of Benjamin, whether he intended this or not. Benjamin was a remnant, wasn't it? At one time, when you look back through redemptive history, you remember from the book of Judges, when and Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, was decimated. Well, more than decimated. People use decimate to say wasted when it's only 1 in 10 to decimate. But at one time, Benjamin was wasted, such that the rest of the tribes of Israel were afraid that they had destroyed it, eliminated it from the face of the earth altogether. Always the smallest tribe of Israel, Benjamin, a remnant they were, and he a tribe from the tribe of Benjamin, Paul. And of course, the fact that God had not abandoned Israel altogether demonstrated in the lives of the other apostles too. They, of course, being Jewish. Well, then, he then asserts the same point negatively. He demonstrates positively how God has not abandoned Israel altogether by saying, "Lo, look at me. I am indeed a Jew, a remnant." But he then asserts the same point negatively. He says, God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. He has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Once again, we come across that term foreknowledge, do we not? We see foreknowledge, prognosko, as the electing love of God. We saw this demonstrated back all the way back to chapter 8, consistently all the way through chapter 9, that foreknowledge is not mere cognitive predetermining, is it? Cognitive pre-knowing. As if God looks down the corridor of time and sees that Dave Bass or Debbie Bass will choose him, and so then he chooses us. That is not the idea of foreknowledge. We have seen indeed, and this in its context demonstrates that it is the love of God, the electing love of God, by which he foreknows. Foreknowledge is the electing love of God versus the qualifying works of man. And make no mistake about this. Man makes the choice independent of circumstances, independent of influence around him. That is a work of man. The kind of free will that most, even most Christians, have in mind when they say, well, I choose God out of my own free will, is a work of man and therefore not grace. So foreknowledge indeed is the electing love of God rather than the qualifying works of man when it comes to election. And that this is that sense of foreknowledge that we describe. And indeed, his people are Israel, the righteous elect, is clear from what follows, too. Points 2 and 3. So let's take out point 2. Point 2, we're talking about the remnant, the Se'arit motif. Remnant. It is demonstrable that God has not rejected Israel altogether the day of Elijah, being Exhibit B. The day of Elijah, being Exhibit B. Now, when I use Exhibit A, B, and C, I'm not ranking them in terms of their importance. This one, indeed, is just as important as an example that God has not rejected Israel altogether as the apostleship of Paul. So, the day of Elijah being Exhibit B, that God has not rejected Israel altogether. And Paul selects one of the many examples of the Se'arit motif he could have, right? And perhaps it's because he sympathizes with Elijah's circumstances. You know, here I'm with my brother apostles. We are the few and the brave, right? Like the Marines. Paul selects this to illustrate how God operates. Do you not know? He asks that rhetorical question, do you not know? It's a way of calling up to memory, indeed, the biblical background they all shared Remember the circumstance, he is saying. That is, Ahab and Jezebel had slain God's prophets. You remember from chapter 18, 17, 18, and 19. Ahab and Jezebel slain God's prophets. They sought to exterminate the worship of God and establish the worship of Baal. And Jezebel, unfazed by Elijah's triumph at Carmel, said that she would do to him what he had done to the prophets, right? You'd think that that triumph at Carmel would have demonstrated the power of God and maybe chagrined Jezebel and Ahab a little bit, but like evil always does, unfazed by Elijah's triumph at Carmel. And this, of course, sent Elijah into a maudlin tailspin. Elijah descended into his prophetic self-pity. I'm the only one left. I am your faithful prophet. But God brings him out of it with one of the great insights, too. And this is one of the great insights into God's omniscience, God's providence, and God's electing love, isn't it? The 7,000 prophets. Paul puts it this way, and this is reflected in the Septuagint. He says, I have kept for myself, demonstrating intention. Not that these 7,000 prophets have somehow, out of their own free will, not bent the knee to Baal, but that God, once of course they do it willingly, yes, they do it willingly. We all act willingly, but that does not mean that it is our will that chooses. I have kept more for myself. Providential. Sovereign. I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. I can imagine Elijah's response. Oh yeah? Where are they? Right? Where are they when I need them? Maybe Paul's thinking along the same lines. Where are they when I need them? And this, in our own lives, should also cause us to think about that couple things, perhaps, that perhaps our compass is considerably narrow when compared to God's. That indeed, He is sovereign. He is directing redemptive history. He is making that quilt out of remnants that may seem pretty chaotic and humble jumble to us, but indeed is being weaved by Him into a marvelous work of grace. And when it comes to seeing the whole, our compass is considerably narrow when compared to God's. And also then, secondly, don't measure the whole mountain by your circumstance in the deep, dark tunnel of chaos. One of my professors at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School would often describe, and he would go through, he had some family troubles at one time, he would call life oftentimes our place in redemptive history individually, which sometimes can seem so narrow. He would call it the deep, dark tunnel of chaos. You know, will America survive as a republic? Will I survive this disease? Will I survive this family problem? Well, when you're in the midst of the deep, dark tunnel of chaos, when all seems disordered and all seems falling apart and nothing looks like it's going to survive or thrive or flourish, you're in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos. But that's not the measure of the whole mountain. There are tunnels and caves all through mountains, are there not? I've been through some of them here in Idaho. And at times it can be all you see of that mountain. Don't measure the whole mountain, however, by your circumstance in the deep, dark tunnel of chaos, even as Elijah was prone to do, as we're all prone and tempted to do. Because it is God's sovereign will, it is God's sovereign control over all of redemptive history that will indeed give us the whole mountain, will give us the whole quilt once it is finished. And Calvin and some of our hyper-reformed, our hyper-five-point Calvinist friends tend to calculate, if you will, the number of elect, right? Who is the elect? How many true this is one of Terry Wright's weaknesses, was to kind of evaluate and try to measure who the elect were and how many there were in the dire depths of the church and so on and so forth. Calvin says, let it also be remembered by us that they are foolish and presumptuous who calculate the number of the elect according to the extent of their own perception. For God has a way, easy to himself, hidden from us, by which he wonderfully preserves his elect, even when all things seem to us past all remedy. See, things can seem to us past all remedy, can they not, when we are in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos? But don't presume to measure God's will, God's hand in redemptive history by the extent of our own perception, as Calvin would call it. Because indeed, he has reserved elect beyond measure. All right. Point two. Point three, then. Remnant. God has not rejected Israel altogether, has he? God has not rejected Israel altogether. He's going to continue to unfold this all through chapter 11 and just what it means. What he means by Israel. What he means by his people. What he means by not rejecting. What he means by bringing back. What he means by flourishing Israel then. Is it by rebuilding the temple? God forbid. Is it by recreating a land? Is it by having separate promises for Israel, separate promises for the church? Well, we'll see. But he has preserved himself a remnant by which he will flourish the church. It is demonstrable that God has not rejected Israel altogether, those chosen by grace being Exhibit C. Those chosen by grace being Exhibit C. Now, by analogy, that's what he means by so too. By analogy, Paul invites us to consider God's electing love in Paul's own day, and by extension, in our own day. See, this is that sense of redemptive history, all through real physical history, time and space. God has practiced this Se'eret motif, this theme. He has practiced this idea of remnant. This is one of his favorite ways of working, is by preserving a remnant from the larger numbers. Paul invites us to consider God's electing love with the remnant in his own day, and then by extension, our own day. We should too. This is biblical theology. And of course, the emphasis here is on God's electing, predestinating love by which a remnant exists. Murray, John Murray, I recommend him to you again. Murray says this pithily. He says, since God's foreknowledge cannot fail of its purpose, there is always a remnant. We extrapolate, right? We extrapolate from the remnant that God must have foreknowledge. He says, no, from God's foreknowledge, we can reason that his foreknowledge cannot fail of its purpose. And since that's the case, there is always a remnant. There is a remnant then. Well, there is a remnant chosen. Chosen how? By looking down the corridors of time and seeing that we would choose him, and so that therefore he chooses us. That's choosing without choice, isn't it? Choosing without a chooser. No. Because they were good enough? He chooses them because they were good enough? No. Otherwise, grace would not be grace, because it is indeed a work. Maybe by government lottery. No. Calvinists and Arminians would be agreed on that. Not by government lottery. No, it's by grace, isn't it? It is by grace. That is, nothing in the creature, as our standards put it, nothing foreseen in the creature, nothing done by the creature, no choice foreseen by the creature. It is by grace. Because free will choice, make no mistake about it, is a work. And works, Paul establishes here, works and grace are mutually exclusive. As Calvin puts it, you seek to establish one, you tear down the other. You seek to establish works and you tear down grace. You seek to establish grace and you tear down works. Works and grace are mutually exclusive. Paul has already reflected on this back in chapter 4. That is, to the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, that is by grace, right? But as his due. Are we due salvation? Are we due election by God just because we think we freely choose? No. It is by grace, then, that he has chosen. And the remnant, that is every individual known intimately. Just think what it means to be a remnant. Every individual known intimately by God, not because they have chosen him, but because he made them and foreknew them. The remnant is chosen, that is elected. That word chosen there is elektos, the idea of being chosen then, elected by grace and no other consideration. You may believe in free will because you feel like you choose, and indeed we feel like we choose. We do choose willingly, but do we choose freely in the sense we conceive free choice? You may believe in free will, but you do so without warrant of the Bible. You may feel it's right and that God wouldn't do it any other way, but you do so because it feels right and comports with what you experience in everyday life. But it does fly in the face of the Bible and of the God the Bible portrays. A lot of people still don't know the God with whom they have to do, because they ignore not only the Old Testament, but the reflection on the God of the Old Testament in the New, as Paul does here. Because God chooses on the basis of the counsel of his own will, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1. God chooses on the basis of the counsel of his own will, which is often unknown to us. And that, for those who want to know, for the curious, right? For the, what's the magazine from which that phrase comes? The Inquirer, the National Enquirer, for inquiring minds. For inquiring minds, that bothers a lot of people, doesn't it? That God does not reveal the basis on which he chooses, the counsel of his own will. God chooses on the basis of the counsel of his own will and upon no other consideration. Who knows in our own day, right? When in many places of the world the church seems pressed and put upon and seems weary and getting smaller and smaller, especially in our own country. When I was in seminary, atheists were numbered at about 2 to 3%. Now, up to 10% confess, if you will, that they are either atheists or agnostics. The church seems put upon, persecuted around the world, but it also is flourishing in many places too, precisely those places where it's persecuted and put upon. So, who knows in our own day, because we are in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos, are we not? And it's hard to predict how or where we'll come out, or if we'll come out from the deep, dark tunnel of chaos. That's been the way of the church throughout redemptive history, God's people. And sometimes we get maudlin and self-pitying like Elijah, do we not? God has preserved a remnant, and in this particular case, a remnant of Israel. So be careful. We are in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos in redemptive history, even as we speak, and do not presume to know, do not presume to judge, because God is indeed not only flourishing Israel, for example, flourishing Jews. There is indeed a revival of amongst Jews. Many Jews are coming to Christ, and we are going to have to be the generation that helps sort out whether replacement theology or covenant theology holds the main place, And indeed, whether Messianic Jews will indeed prevail in the radical sense or in the moderate sense. But we are in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos. I'm just thankful that God is... I spent 2 years in a Jewish prayer fellowship at Trinity, and I saw some of these issues. This was back in the 80s. I saw some of these same issues beginning to surface. Jews aren't agreed on these things either. I remember I just sat back. I was as the goyim there, the goyim flower on the wall, as they were sorting out these issues, these Messianic Jews, sorting out these issues. Are we members? Are we part of the church, or is the church part of Israel? Is Israel now grafted into the life of the church, or has the church been grafted into Israel? And back and forth they would go on these issues. So we are still in the deep, dark tunnel of redemptive history, even as we speak. And these issues will be sorted out. But we have to be ready and willing to stand and have our thinking caps on and be prepared to face these issues. Do not presume to know. Well, let us now come to that place where we see, and we are still the one whole people of God. Let us now come to that place where we see the one whole people of God represented in the simple elements of the body and blood of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.